Good evening, everyone. You've tuned into Paradigm Shifters again, and we have a wonderful paradigm shifter who's going to take you through a different way of doing, I was going to say psychological therapy, but anyway, it's called Buddhist psychology, and it's quite a different approach to many of the therapies that we're all accustomed to. My guest tonight is Karuna Caton, who is the author of Misleading Mind, and also quite the practitioner of Buddhist psychology and therapy, I guess we'll call it, eh? Welcome to the show.
Glad to be here.
This is a very interesting book. And I've often said to people, life is like a big math exam. And right at the smaller heading on your book is how we create our own problems and how Buddhist psychology can help you solve them. But all the way through the book, it's supposed to be about embracing your problems too, isn't it?
That's a lot of it. You know, it's well, first of all, it's interesting to me that most people will not know that Buddhism, that a 2,500, 2,600-year-old tradition, has a very, very robust and complete articulation of psychology.
That is a surprise, actually.
It is. I mean, mm-hmm. People think of Buddhism like religion, mm-hmm. whereas, you know, His Holiness Dalai Lama, who's probably the leader of the Tibetan Buddhist tradition anyway, often refers to Buddhism as mind science, which I find just amazing, because if you were to deconstruct the word psychology, it would be pretty close to mind science, the study of the mind. So isn't that interesting?
That's really interesting. Also, somewhere at the beginning here, there's the meaning of Buddhism. What is the meaning that says something about going within?
Oh, the word for Buddhist in the Tibetan language is a word that is Nangpa. Nangpa means an inner being.
Ah.
So I thought, wow, what amazing description, because when you and I talk about, oh, he's a Buddhist or he's a Christian or whatever, or an atheist, when we say he's a Buddhist, you know, we really could say, oh, what if we said, oh, he's an inner being? And it's a very different. It brings up a very different image than Buddhist, because that has all the preconceptions. So an inner being simply means that we begin to look at the world and the struggles and difficulties and happiness from an inner locus as opposed to an external locus. And that's a big shift for us to make.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I think the theme of the book, not just the book, but all of Buddhist practice and psychology.
Well, and the thing you've talked about is it's called the misleading mind. So you're saying basically it's unhooking the edicts of that mind. Is that it? Like getting in touch with our mind?
Yeah, there's also, it's funny, there's also a leading mind, if I could use it that way. In other words, the problem from this description is that, or from the Buddhist psychological point of view, all problems arise from seeing things, seeing reality, seeing situations incorrectly.
Mm.
So that, why do we see them incorrectly? Is we have certain qualities within our minds that we've had all the time. You know, sometimes they're referred to as ignorance or not knowing or confusion. And what we're confused by is how a situation really exists as opposed to responding to it from the point of view of our projection of the problem, projection of the situation. So those are we can almost say there's misleading minds, but, you know, for sake of this discussion right now, there's a misleading mind. There's a way, an internal psychological mechanism that we view the world with that is incorrect. Now, there's also qualities of the mind that are wise and compassionate and correct.
Mm-hmm.
And so I just need to get that message out, too. But this is really talking about if we don't know that we have a misleading mind, then it's very hard to just get out of this problem by focusing on merely the positive.
Mm-hmm. Well, that doesn't work, does it? I mean, the positive.
No. I mean, it's very helpful. And from a Buddhist approach, it doesn't work. And also, I think in the book we talk about the very, very, very first teaching that the historical Buddha gave after he became awakened. And awakened means he became mentally healthy.
Mm-hmm.
was the teaching people often hear called the Four Noble Truths. And the first noble truth being the truth of suffering. And I hear a lot in my workshops and trainings and around that, you know, wow, Buddha's kind of a negative guy. You know, what do you start with the suffering part? Let's talk about all that's beautiful and good in the world.
Right.
And the reason he did is because that's a reality that we don't come are not familiar with. We don't really know that we are in a state of confusion and suffering. And even if we didn't, we don't really know what that means. So he felt without knowing the enemy, you can't really conquer it. So that's that approach. It is, and that's why without knowing the misleading mind, we cannot access those qualities of our mind that have high potential.
So if you're being a positive thinker, you might be avoiding or ignorant of the deeper problem stuff. Is that right?
Definitely. What happens is, in terms of merely positive thinking, is that we have, and neuroscience will support this, that we have habitual patterns.
Mm-hmm.
And it's true that we can overcome many of those habitual patterns through generating the opposite, which would be a positive pattern. But, you know, ultimately, we have to really go into the negativity, if you want to put it that way, the hard stuff, really understand it well. And then the positive approaches that we'll apply will be accurate and well-informed and direct to those negative qualities.
So before we get very, because I would really like to pick your brains on that, but where did you get all this? Weren't you in a temple, or weren't you in a meditative retreat over there somewhere?
I had kind of a, yes. in 1975, it was one of those, you know, products of the 60s. And, you know, I got stuck in college because I made a commitment to my mother that I would go, and even though I didn't want to. And
that sounds like a familiar story.
Yeah, it didn't work for me. You know, school wasn't my forte. But I made a commitment, and I went. And fortunately, and I was interested, I'd become interested pre-college. I'd become interested in this Eastern movement. You know, the Beatles were going to the East, and Ram Dass, and, you know, there was quite
Maharishi.
Starting to kind of have this relationship with the East, mostly through yoga and the Hindu tradition. And so I became involved in that and became very interested in Eastern thought. And so in college, the way I made it work was I studied, you know, my major was Asian studies. And lo and behold, in the third year, my junior year, there was a year in Nepal program. And I looked at a map. I saw Nepal was near India. I thought, good, I can go sneak across the border and find my guru. And, you know, no one will, you know, it'll all be cool. Anyway, I ended up in Nepal in 1975 and absolutely loved it and stayed more than the year. I stayed a year and a half, came back, finished my one semester bachelor's degree, and then I had been asked by the abbot of the monastery where I had been studying and working, teaching young monks English, to come back and set up in a whole Western studies program for the monks, the young monks in this particular monastery. So I returned after about a year, year and a half here in the States, and I stayed another, I don't know, 10, 11 years.
Wow, you really loved it, eh?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I was really, really resonated well for me. And I mean, it was a lot of hardship and hard work living in a third world country. But I was not a monk, but I lived in the monastery. I met my Australian wife there, and two of our three kids were born in Nepal. And then we moved back. No, we moved to the States. She had never lived here, but moved back here in 1988. I then got, if you could try to think how, after all those years, 1975, 1988, being in Nepal, how was I going to, what was I to do here? And the logical response was, why don't you get a clinical psychology degree? So that's what I did. I got my master's in clinical psych.
And but by then you were quite a meditator, were you?
Well, you know, we really strongly believe that, you know, we have to practice what we learn,
mm-hmm.
attempt to practice. So I would say I'm a practitioner.
Mm-hmm.
And the practice in Buddhist psychology. So what I was studying was Buddhism, but really what I was studying was Buddhist psychology and Buddhist philosophy. And if you're going to study a psychology, then you really have to, you know, you're really going to have a system of therapy, right?
Right.
I think most psychological theories will have a system of therapy. Well, the system of therapy in Buddhist tradition is through what I like to call mind training rather than meditation, because mind training is very specifically what meditation in our tradition is supposed to be about. So it's not just about focusing on your breath, say, or it has to do with the intention of understanding and then taming the mind, and that's what makes us psychologically healthy. Mind training could include other activities other than meditation. There are some other things people can do that do train the mind, but the principal one is through meditation, correct meditation.
And so when you're doing mind training and meditation combined, is the meditation about looking at your own reactions, or what is it?
Yeah, that's part of it. Mm-hmm. It's really, in the Buddhist psychological theory that we learn is you are given a map, in a sense, a number of different schematics on how to understand the mind. So you take these sort of lenses, lenses to look at the mind, and one day you might use this particular approach, another day you might use this, and all these approaches give you different understandings of how the mind functions and how problems function, and then the solutions to those. So that's why we don't have a one-size-fits-all. People have different capacities, personalities, and different problems. So that's why we don't believe that, merely, say, watching the breath is a panacea to every different kind of emotional disturbance. There are many, many, many thousands of different kinds of emotional disturbances.
I so like different. Right at the introduction when you talk about the Rinpoche saying, I think it was the Rinpoche Lama, saying that if you're just helping people feel better, there is no benefit.
Yes, that's huge.
It's huge. It's huge. I want you to talk about that.
And I don't know if I said, I can't remember if I said in the book, but I think I did say that, that was specifically, that has to be taken in context, right? It was directed at me, and this has to do with him saying that as a direct comment upon what the Buddhist psychology believes is the root of problems. So, the root of the problem is not so much that, the electricity goes out today and I have no heating. That's not what it's about. The root of when we talk about problems, it's an internal thing. So it's more around the pain and suffering, discomfort that my mind goes through by not having electricity today.
Okay.
So, if someone comes, and then let's say I'm talking, you come around, Veronica, you see, and I'm kind of all agitated by not having electricity today, and you go, yeah, that's hard, and you give me a hug.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of
a feel better hug.
That's the feel better hug, and that's not really, at least for me, with all my background, he was saying, that's not good enough for you. Why don't you do something more, do something deeper that's going to actually help people's minds get rid of the dissatisfaction, the disturbance, the irritation that arises when their heat goes out. That would be a better solution.
And so how can you give us, that's a perfect example. How do you do that then?
Well, it really is, it's really case specific, right? But it begins by, you mentioned earlier in the hour about embracing problems. And it's really, embracing may not be the right word, but it really is about going into the issue itself. So if I'm agitated, disturbed, uncomfortable, it's really about looking at where that arises from. And again, that goes back to those maps that were presented, many, many different kinds of maps. I might want to use this map today or that map tomorrow for that particular problem. But so you begin to it's not a reframing, it's a begin to really deconstruct your dissatisfaction and trying to understand what the causes are. Causes are really, really important. And there are many in modern psychology, there's some models that have thrown out the whole idea of looking at causes because of a reaction to the earlier days of psychology when causes were usually, and they still are, pinned on our parents, our mother, DNA, society. So these are not the causes within the Buddhist psychology. Those are conditions.
Mm-hmm.
But we're really looking at how to confront the causes of dissatisfaction, the causes of anger, the causes of irritation.
So they might be things like self-esteem because you didn't set it up right, or
yeah,
a memory of something.
I see things because I see, what did Anais Nin say is, we don't see things as they are, we see things as we are.
Right.
And that's probably the central Buddhist concept.
I call it projectile thought.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, it's really interesting. So that's mind training, right?
Yes. That's a mind training because you begin to see, train your mind to see things differently, train your mind to be suspicious of the way we do see things. And the interesting thing about this is the sort of booming research around neuroscience is that it supports these ideas in very similar ways.
Hmm. That's interesting.
Yeah,
so it's just all, so basically it's like, oh, I tease people. I go, yeah, it is all about me. You know, people say it isn't all about you, you know.
Yeah.
Because it is. You're saying you have to go into inner referral, right?
You do. Yes. And which brings to another level of, because that can be, that can sound, and actually can become very self-absorbed and self-centered, by the way.
But to a degree, it has to be a bit, doesn't it?
Well, I think, you know, it's tricky because it is about understanding oneself and how we function. But then we have to, and this is where it gets, you know, very intricate, is we have to also pay attention to our intentions.
Okay.
So, because that's also part of our inner working. So if we understand what the cause of problems are, which is, by the way, self-centeredness, so we kind of like have to focus on the self and how it gets us in trouble by understanding that it's the problem. So it becomes very prevalent that, you know, like sometimes people say of depression is really becomes very self-absorbed. I want to be happy. I want to be happy. I want to be happy. I want to be, and the more that you think I'm going to work on being happy, you know, in a way, the more entrenched you become in the depressed mind state.
Hmm.
You know, so this idea of compassion, that's why you often do hear in Buddhist psychology about compassion. Compassion is not just about feeling good and it's the right thing to do. It's actually a psychological mechanism to be healthy ourselves. So, you know, and I think research, there's a lot of research, which I can't quote at the moment, but there's a lot of research coming out now about the qualities of thinking of others, the quality, you know, the therapeutic effects on the mind of happy, you know, creating happiness by considering others through empathy, through compassion, through caring and affection for others. So this is huge, and it's not part of my book, as you'll notice. I mean, I think the very last chapter I talk a little bit about compassion, but this is a whole book in itself as a psychological, therapeutic approach that compassion is a healthy thing to do.
And is a part of that learning compassion, like when you're into the it's all about me part, you
yeah.
can actually step into the other person's all about
them.
Himself one, and that empathy helps develop the compassion.
Empathy is so
right?
huge. You know, which compassion is we describe it as, it's sort of it's a next step to empathy, by the way.
Oh, is it? Okay.
Yeah, they're not synonymous. Although people define empathy so many different ways, a number of different ways. But compassion is really the action of empathy. Empathy can be somewhat passive, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, but compassion is not passive. It's actually an act of urging to do something about another person's difficulties, suffering, pain. You know.
That, do you call that part of the mind training?
Yeah, but it's not definitely a huge part. Maybe 50%.
Oh wow, really?
Yeah, it's just not in the Tibetan Buddhist tradition. I would say it's 50%. The other 50% is the wise perspective, the correct perspective on how things arise. And then if we really have a correct perspective on how problems arise, actually the funny thing is we automatically become compassionate towards others.
Hmm. Well, that makes sense. So are people in Tibet, are they nicer? know what I mean. Is there a collective response to this? Or is it a common thing? Is it
special? I would say Tibetan, there is a collective. I don't want to romanticize the Tibetan culture, but I mean, part of the problem is in Tibet, you know, they're under the oppression of the sort of Chinese government. And this is quite sad, but there's many Tibetans out who, you know, refugees, and I think in Tibet themselves as a culture and the Tibetans outside of Tibet as a culture, yeah, it, you know, and again, not to romanticize, but they do have a quality of empathy and compassion that seems to be culturally embedded.
So it must be ingrained in the little ones.
Yeah, and I think you'll find that in many other cultures too, that have a strong, and I've been to other Buddhist countries, and I'm not going to say just Buddhism provides that. I think it has to do with those kinds of embedded values that kids will learn that are from a young age about, you know, caring for others and empathy and how things are. And, you know, we as a modern, I hate to say Western, because where's the West anymore? But, you know, this idea of, one of my soapboxes, I have several in my closet.
Oh, bring them out.
One is about individuation.
Okay.
Western modern psychology has been very big on this idea of individuation and the individual, and both socially constructed and as well as a psychological approach, right? Mm-hmm. And in one way, in many ways, that I think has been a little bit of our undoing, because this idea of I come first, kind of, and I'm entitled to be happy, which is okay. We are entitled to be happy, but I think the approach to that seems to be shallow and not very.
It doesn't seem to apply compassion to a lot of others.
No, that's the problem.
Yeah, so that's a big difference as far as.
Yeah.
Also, it's thinking in kind of. Group? Not the group. Yeah, it's thinking of respect for a lot of people, right?
Say that again?
It's thinking in terms of respecting others.
I think we just got to, when we realize that our interconnection, you know, it is, you know, Holiness Dalai Lama says frequently, if you're going to be selfish, why not be wisely selfish? And that's what we're talking about. This wise selfishness is, you know, by me caring and respecting others, I benefit. That's the thing. I want to be respected.
Right.
I want to be cared for.
Right.
Well, you know, that's not going to come from disrespecting and not caring for others. It's kind of a simple formula. You know, people don't really want to be around you if you're just so self-absorbed. You know, we know those people.
Mm-hmm.
It's all about me, self-absorbed, my needs, my wants, and you know, that's the human condition, of course, but the solution to that is really not by focusing on it more, but by realizing that other people want the same thing. So we both want that parking space, don't we?
Mm-hmm.
You know, that last one you pull in front of the supermarket. We both want the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
One page here, you've got this is how problems help. We create a different kind of relationship with our problems. So, and that makes a lot of sense to me. So what if somebody is self-absorbed, depressed, and, you know, completely locked within? How would you work with someone like that?
Well, this is something I had to learn, which is, sounds easy,
mm-hmm.
but it's really, for me anyway, was a very profound lesson for me to learn, and that is a change really doesn't happen very quickly.
Okay.
It's really, for most of us, I mean, of course, it's slow. And the reasons for that, at least scientifically now, I begin to understand more in terms of, you know, these are patterns that we've developed for at least since we were born, you know, maybe not always, but, you know, it can be patterns that we're born with. You know, they're in our what I call our mental DNA.
Mm.
And so to think that I, you know, that's when now a change that's happened suddenly, like through a trauma,
mm-hmm.
Or some sort of change, you know, I think those are a little bit easier to work with.
Is it like dismantling a number of belief structures or reactions?
Well, when you think of a problem, you know, that I struggle with, let's say I struggle with insecurity, you know, doubting myself.
Okay.
You know, if that happened and it was reinforced as a child, I'm not saying the cause was my parents telling me that I couldn't do much and you're just helpless, you know. But if that's not the cause, but those conditions reinforce an already, you know, something I have in my personality that has sort of self-doubt. And so you think about that and repeating those patterns, that negative self-talk to myself, you know, as soon as I might move out of the home, but then as any work environment I'm in, that dialogue's continuing, my relationships. That's a lot of dialogue. You know, let's say whatever age you are, let's say you're 40, you know, 40 years, 30 years of that.
Mm-hmm. It's our programming, great. Right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so it's not easy to change that. It's not just through a decision, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, decisions are good, but sometimes people say, I just made a decision and I changed. And that's great. That can happen. But for the most of us, it's a matter of chipping away and then creating new dialogues, the new mental habits. And that's hard. It takes time.
It helps me understand to have more compassion with somebody who might be frustrated.
Exactly.
With. Yeah.
Unless, well, I mean, I can get very impatient with people. Like, you know, can't you see? Why don't you see?
Yeah, we already talked about that, right?
Yeah, exactly. Maybe just go get a job.
I know. Yeah, it's a really interesting. That whole trauma of being a human being in transformation. What do you think of karma? Do the Buddhists? Do they use karma as well?
Huge.
Okay.
Yeah, but, you know, I didn't talk about it. If I do another book, I often tell people, if I do another book, there's two topics that I avoided in this present book, purposely. It wasn't the place for it.
Right.
And one of those topics is karma, and I like to really, really express clearly now what that means, because that word has become sort of familiarized, right? It's become mainstreamed in some ways, and it's really not understood from my experience what that means. Karma, the word itself, means action, and particularly it means sort of mental action, which is not the way we usually think of it. Most people talk about karma as fate. It does not mean fate. It's a very complex topic, and it's very, very, very expressed and explained in Buddhist psychology. Very, I mean, it's, you know, there's thousands and thousands of pages written on this topic. So it's a lot more than fate. And just to make a really, if I can just put a simple expression, really karma means the law of cause and effect.
Mm-hmm.
But again, what we do with that, we say, you know, well, a tree fell on my car, you know, I guess I had some bad karma. Again, not a correct understanding. Sure, there was cause and effect there, but specifically, I think, or most definitively, why this topic of karma is so profound and why it's not really part of our modern culture is we're talking about mental cause and effect more than physical cause and effect. So if I'm feeling depressed today, that's due to karma, because karma here means mental imprints.
Okay.
If anyone ever asks, what does karma mean, I would say it's the mental imprints and the effects of those imprints. That's karma. That's cause and effect.
And that's soul stuff?
Soul?
Mm-hmm.
I don't use the word because people have so many different definitions of soul. It's mental.
Okay.
I'm not saying there's no soul. I just people always define it differently.
Just as when you're talking about mental, I'm going, are we born? We're born with a lot of those, right?
That's why I called it mental DNA.
Yeah, okay, right.
And so those imprints, and that's the second topic of the next book, is about rebirth, you know, which just sounds so, you know, so mystical, psychic. And it's hard. The problem with rebirth is that it does take a certain level of faith, and that's why we don't like it. But if you look at it from the psychological point of view and this idea of imprints, for example, you and I are speaking now, right?
Mm-hmm.
And we have we have five lenses that we're experiencing this. You know, our eyes, our nose, our hearing, our taste and the tactile, and then there's the there's actually six. There's the mental sense of thoughts and feelings, that sort of thing. So we're having gazillions of experiences in the last, 40 minutes that you and I have been chatting, right?
Mm-hmm.
So all of those are imprints. And those imprints have different strengths. If I'm feeling really angry at you, then that has a stronger, so I might be talking and yelling at you. That's a stronger imprint than if we're just having a casual conversation or if we're having a warm conversation. It's all different imprints.
Right.
Those are seeds. That's what karma is. And the only difference is in the explanation of karma, those mental imprints will ripen sometime. And by the way, right now they're ripening. The ones from the past are ripening now.
Mm.
That's our so.
So they'll express through your activities or through your response to people or life. Yeah.
They're all. We have a constant filming, videotaping, video. What do you call it? Going on through the six senses, five physical and the mental sense.
So even when we're not conscious about it.
Even when we're not conscious.
Mm-hmm.
Even when we're sleeping, even when we're in a coma, there's still a level of filming that's going on. And that filming is, those are the images that are stored on the film, which is on the mind itself, on the mental consciousness, on the consciousness itself. So that's one thing. We're constantly filming. The second thing is we're constantly projecting previous slides, previous video images, you see. That's why we don't see things as they are. We see things as they're projected.
So that's a major frontier is for us to get aware of that.
Huge. And we're not even... And by the way, by saying this, it doesn't mean that what we see is not there. I want to be very clear. It's just that we don't see it in the way that it is there. It's kind of like we just see it incorrectly. It doesn't exist the way it appears.
We give it different motivations or something.
Different motivation, different perspectives.
Yeah, that makes sense. Isn't it interesting? I mean,
yeah.
So let's. I would love you to talk a little bit more about the training, the untrained mind. And you have, let me see here. You have a little list of things that people go through, right?
Yeah.
Would you want to talk a bit about that?
Well.
You don't have to do a whole list. It's just that there's sort of sequences that people listening might be really able to use, you know?
Well, I think what I've been told over these couple years that since the book came out, that almost 2 years now, that the four steps that are explained in the book are the right place to start. And that is the what we talked about earlier in the program about number one. Okay, so the first thing we need to do is know that we have a choice. So let's say I begin to, feel, irritated with someone, someone I'm working with. They're just starting to get to me, right?
Mm-hmm.
So normally what we do is we just react. Oh, maybe I should keep my mouth shut. Oh, maybe I should say this. Or maybe you blow up. Or maybe you just blurt something. Okay. So the first step is knowing that we actually have a choice on how we respond. That's freedom.
Mm.
People often ask, do we have free choice? And the answer is, for me, it depends, right? You have free choice, but because we never actualize it, we don't have free choice.
Because we're ignorant of it, right?
We're ignorant of it. We tend to be in reaction,
right.
Always in reaction. Whatever comes in front of us, we react to it.
Mm-hmm.
So the first step is knowing that you have a choice on how to respond, and you can begin to change your universe.
By intending to do that, right?
Yeah, just that intention, just stopping and knowing. The second step is, is then going, oh, what is it that's arising in my mind? And, in this sense, it's, well, I'm irritated. So you caught that. And now there's a gap in the whole reactive process. Third step is, which is a little bit more extensive, is you know, more or less have to read in the book itself. But it's about checking in, you know, unless you're driving or you got to be, you connect with the breath in this case. It could be many things, but in this presentation, just connect with the breath. You check your body. Where's the tension? And just focus on, bring the focus to the breath for a few moments. It could be a long period of, 10 breaths or 20 breaths, whatever, but, or it could just be 3 breaths. And it's described in the book in a little more detail. So that then just brings that sense, creates more space. The fourth step is you got to do something about it. And in the doing something about it, it can be many things, such as just letting it go, watching it float, like, as if this whole irritation was like a cloud in the sky. It could be this understanding that, wow, it's already passed.
Mm.
It's just moving like a river. And there's many different approaches that you just then transfer. Or you can even go to the point of feeling, wow, what is this teaching me? This is great. I got to learn something about my internal world right now.
Mm.
So those are different parts of step 4 and those 4 steps. So that's what the fourth step is. There are thousands of things to do. I mentioned several in there, but there's, from Buddhist psychological approach, there's really many, many, many different things to do.
But in essence, it's like changing or reframing the problem from the inside out.
Yes.
Right?
The reframe, which I don't really like that word so much, because sometimes it means it's someone else's idea, right? When you reframe, it's like you're a therapist and you say, I'm really angry at my brother for, not paying me back that money. And then they reframe it and say, well, it sounds good that he didn't pay you back because, you got to be a more generous person. Well, that's all good. But that's not your description. Do you know what I mean?
Yes, I do, yeah.
Yeah, so I typically with reframing, I have a negative point of view, but it's not all negative. It is a reframe in the highest sense that you see it sincerely and authentically in a different way that's more productive for you.
So what would it be like, oh, my brother didn't pay me back, so I'm seeing that I helped him through a pickle, and that's love or something.
But you have to be sincere that you really feel like, for me, in my case, maybe what I would be thinking about is how much I really do want to be a generous person. And, and I also don't like the feeling of being taken advantage of.
Mm-hmm.
That is pretty common in our culture, by the way. Like, oh, he shouldn't do that to you. This victim sense. And
I see. That's really important, what you just said about the being taken advantage of. That's
yeah.
a huge thing.
Yeah, and how do I really want to be that guy that feels taken advantage of? I mean, so there's two responses to not being that guy taken advantage of. Go to my brother and ask him, take his car and sell it so I get paid back. Or become the person that I would prefer to be, which is someone that's not, granted, he owes me the money. That,
mm-hmm.
You're not dismissing that fact, but you're working, you're becoming an inner being, which is that who I really prefer to be, as a victim that says, because my brother didn't pay me back, I'm taken for granted? That's a decision. That's just a mental concept. Really, the real thing is that he's not able to pay me back or not wanting to, and, it's about him that's not honoring his debt. For me, that doesn't determine how I have to be.
Mm-hmm.
So I have to think, I have certain values in my case. I have values of who I want to be.
Mm-hmm.
And one of them is not to be a resentful, taken-for-granted victim. That's just not healthy for me.
It's not one of your big goals.
No. And people will talk you into, even being that thing.
Yeah.
You shouldn't be. And they'll say, well, the reaction to that is go and take his car and, make him, sue him. Get a lawyer. And it doesn't work that way. That's still not who you want to be or who I want to be.
But it's really difficult sometimes to relinquish the resentment or the judgment of your brother. Yeah, that's
huge.
Very interesting. That's pretty common, not necessarily about the money, but that sort of issue is very huge, isn't it?
Well, I want to throw a little provocative.
We like that.
Yeah, oh, do you? Okay. So we were talking about karma before.
Right.
And I was saying, well, really karma is an internal thing. It's not really external.
Right.
And has, and it's a mental process, right?
Mm-hmm.
So my whole experience of my brother,
mm-hmm.
the debt, he calls, can't pay you. When you, we are so fixated and hypnotized that everything is external, right?
Mm-hmm.
But when I'm getting that information about my brother, I'm getting it through my ears and my eyes, right? Mostly.
Mm-hmm.
And at what point are those mental images and sounds outside of me, and what point are those mental images and or those images and sounds inside of me? So it's very hard. When you begin, when we begin to deconstruct that and analyze, it's extremely tough to find where the external world starts and the internal world ends.
I mean, a subject like that could be deeply a kind of a sibling rivalry. My mom.
But what is my, but of my experience of being taken advantage of, not getting my money?
Right.
What in that experience is external and what is internal? When you come from the point of view and really analyze deeply through your mind training, most of that experience is internal.
Hmm.
Even the image of my brother, is that external? The image itself, you know, when we see something,
mm-hmm.
it's reflected in the mind itself, actually. That's how sight happens. Sight is not in the person. Like, the sight happens inside our minds and our brain.
Right.
So all of that interpretation is internal. That's what karma is. So the data is the same. He didn't pay me back. And there's my wife and there's me. Don't we have different experiences of that, though?
Yeah.
So I'm all, like, pissed off and feeling victimized. And my wife says, well, it's okay, you know, because he really needed the money and they have a hard life. Who's right?
Well, nobody in a way, but
yeah.
As far as changing it around, yeah.
So why not produce a more helpful, and this is not being Pollyannish, by the way, but you create a more helpful interpretation because you have a choice to be happy or not happy.
That's right.
So we have, and then we have to know what is happy and not happy. So, you know, because people don't know really what means happiness, which I think is internal mental health.
Mm-hmm.
So if I have the idea that internal mental health is my definition of happiness, and then my brother rips me off or can't pay me, do I have to not be mentally healthy and happy because he did that? No, I have a choice. I'm not a victim. You never, well, I shouldn't say never, but, you know, really, that's where the misleading mind tells us, oh, it's all about my brother. That's why I'm not happy, because mm-hmm. he ripped me off. That's crap.
Mm-hmm.
The reason I'm not happy is because my mental attitude is producing a perspective that produces unhappiness for me.
But Karuna, could it be like, for example, ego? My identity is miffed. That sort of thing.
Yeah, that's mm-hmm. all of it. That's all that mm-hmm. stuff. So much. It's very intricate. Yes. So many different. Remember, I said there's many maps and different ways to look at it. So one is can be exactly what you said. You know, what's my identity in all this? And it's through. Again, identity is probably one of the biggest objects of focus in Buddhist psychology. So what if my identity was different than how I think I am? Like, what if, you know, then my reaction to my brother not paying me back changes entirely.
Hmm.
What if my identity is I'm really wealthy and I just love giving money away? So, what about that? You know,
yeah.
That would... My identity would respond differently to him not paying me back. What if my identity is I just want to help people and I just want to give as much money away as if that helps people, and that's sort of the thing, because I'm not really not that attached to the money anyway. I want to try and help in whatever way I can.
Mm-hmm.
And then you gave it to him. I never loaned it. I gave it happily.
But then sometimes we can get egocentric and go, oh, but I wanted to choose.
Yeah.
I wanted to be my choice.
It comes back to us.
I'm sure we all have that same kind of feeling at times,
yeah.
Right? That's very, isn't that interesting? So the process is, in your working with people, you would use a process sort of like that to help them reassess?
Yes. It's kind of brutally, it's a little more brutal. If you really work with someone, then it really is about having to take accountability and responsibility for your happiness. And if you, I mean, no one else is going to do it for us. And so...
Well, can you take us through a sample of some sort?
Well, if someone comes in and is talking about how... Now, by the way, I can't always do this because mm-hmm. people are not always wanting to take an inner approach, right? They're not,
right.
quote-unquote, inner beings.
Right.
So, you know, for those who are not, I have to just approach from a traditional Western modern... Well, I can't purely... approach it because I have my mindset, you know, but I have to be respectful of where they're at.
Right.
So I can't impose laws. Now, I work with a lot of people who actually do have some interest in coming from an internal. Not that they're Buddhist, you know, they could be any kind of person that kind of gets it that this internal world is and potential is what we're really needing to focus on. And so if someone comes and I'm working with them and they have that attitude, they need to just begin to deconstruct how the problems arise. And that's both interpretation, perspective, their identity, all kinds. You never know where it's going to go, but it's focused internally rather than externally. And now, normally any psychotherapist will say, well, that's what I do. I only focus on the internal. And that may be correct. But then you got to look at, well, what is your map of the internal? And that's where we need, that's about education. The education and the theory is different for me than what would I call traditional psychotherapeutic theory.
Do people get very emotional or very resistant sometimes?
I don't know about resistance. It's funny. I don't really... Because, my style is also I don't push. You know, I really listen to what their capacity and capabilities are and what their worldview is and more come from their language. I don't impose. I mean, I work with many people that, I mean, eventually they know I'm Buddhist, but they don't feel that I'm putting a Buddhist trip on them
mm-hmm.
because I don't, unless they're Buddhist and they want to come from that more traditional perspective. But these are universal ideas, and that's what I explained in the book. People should, I really want, you know, one thing, another soapbox to get out of the closet, is Buddhist theory and psychology and philosophy is universal. It's not limited to Tibet. It's not limited to India or Nepal or China or Korea or Japan. These ideas are spread throughout much of the Eastern world are very different cultures.
Mm-hmm.
Sri Lanka is a completely different culture from Japan.
Mm-hmm.
And yet Buddhist ideas have gone. Why? Because they're universal ideas. They're about the human mind, and the human mind is not culturally defined. So in the same way with someone coming in to working with me is that's they're coming with their culture. I mean, their personal culture, if you know
mm-hmm.
what I mean. And it's my job to sort of look how I can integrate with them.
I think it's really interesting that you have a very, kind of a centering and accepting vibration. I know you're strong, but, you know, I can feel that. And that really makes a difference with people, too. That's your intention, isn't it?
Yeah, you know, I don't know, you know, either way, but, they've shown, in the research has shown in modern psychology, and psychotherapy, rather, that they have a number of studies that analyzer did, you know, exit studies with effective psychotherapy where clients felt that therapy was effective, and they asked, I think there were 8 different criteria, you know, was it the therapist's model? Was it their technique? Was it their interventions? Was it their hairdo. I don't know if that was one of them, but 85%, I think it was 85%, I hope I'm not misquoting, 85% of the responses were that it was the relationship with the therapist
that
was
makes sense
most
to me.
Therapeutic.
That makes sense.
And you
sense.
Think about that, you know, when we study, we get trained in psychotherapy, you know, we're not trained 85% of the time in developing the relationship. I mean, that happens, by the way, depending on the school you attend and whatnot. But mostly we're learning about psychopathology, and we're learning about therapeutic technique, and we're learning about theory, and, you know, that sort of thing. I think in Buddhist tradition, the idea of developing oneself as a compassionate being
mm-hmm.
is huge.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm not saying I'm compassionate, but the...
You feel fairly compassionate.
Well, you know...
You haven't yelled at me yet.
Not yet. Give us another hour. No. But, you know, the compassion element, you feel that with a person.
Yeah,
right?
I think you do. You really do, actually. Yeah.
So that's therapeutic. If people who meet His Holiness Dalai Lama, to almost everyone, will say, wow. You know, and what is it about him? You know, you feel so good after you're just around him.
Mm-hmm.
And His Holiness has said himself, well, when I meet anytime I meet someone and everyone I relate to, what I think of that person is that they're my friend.
Aww.
Can you imagine?
That's wonderful.
Yeah, he feels...
Not exactly defensive, I'd say. Mm-hmm.
No.
Wow.
So he feels a connection. He feels... You know, that comes from really understanding truly compassion.
Yeah, that's not just his mind, his psychological set.
No, he's trained so much that it's spontaneous. It's not intellectual and it's not intellectual. It's not, what's that word I'm looking for?
It's a beingness sort of thing.
Right.
Yeah. Tell me now, you do workshops. Where do you do them? And I know you're in Santa Cruz. That's loaded with Tibetan majesty, isn't it?
Yeah. Uh-huh. I live in a very lucky place. I mean, if you're gonna move from Nepal, Santa Cruz is a good choice. But... I do trainings and classes. It just varies. I do them, you know, I travel some, and I mean, not do travel, but during different times of the year. I'm also developing my online presence because it just, you know, I can't be everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
And so in the next, like, for example, in the next month, I'm teaching a series here in Santa Cruz called Becoming Your Own Therapist.
Oh, great.
Yeah, and that was a term that my teacher used. And it's a four-week class. I'm doing slightly different. It's four classes over 4 weeks. But I'm going to videotape it, and it'll be available on my site after the class. So those kinds of things I want to do more of so that people can access. And, of course, I got a blog and Facebook page and all that sort of thing.
And what's your website? Is it Karuna Katon? Is that it, or is it?
It's karunagroup.com.
Karunagroup.com?
.com, yeah.
Wonderful.
I think if you do a search for Karuna Katon, then the Karuna Group will come up, yeah.
And Karuna is your Tibetan name?
Yeah, it's actually Sanskrit. It's funny thing on that was remember I told you I was back in the 60s, early 70s?
Oh, yes.
The yoga tradition. I had a Hindu teacher who gave me the name, and then I tried to drop the name when I moved to Nepal because I was no longer feeling like I was in that yoga tradition. But Karun is also a Nepali name.
Oh, yeah, nice.
Nepali being a Sanskrit-based language. So people there started calling me Karuna, so I couldn't drop it. So.
It's nice. I like it. It's very unusual. It's good.
Well, there's a lot of Johns in the world. You know?
Is that what you were before?
That's what I was.
Before you changed your mind?
That's what I was before, yeah.
Well, I've really enjoyed talking with you. You've got me thinking, and I love this book. We didn't cover it all. I'm eager to read your karma book one day.
My next book, yeah.
Yeah. Is it coming out soon, or are you thinking about
it? Well, I haven't started writing, but I feel I have to do a follow-up at some point, and I am collecting the material on that, but, you know, writing a book is not that easy.
So no, I know. It's
I have
really
to kind
grueling.
Of gear up for it again, and but it's a labor of love, so.
But that whole subject of, you know, getting into our minds, and it does seem like it's fathomless at times,
yes.
So that's why I kind of am
Isn't
curious.
Isn't that fun, though?
It is, actually, yeah. I do find it, you know, I do some, but anyway, I don't talk about me, but I thank you so much for joining us and for being a paradigm shifter.
Thank you for letting me blah, blah, blah about myself all this whole hour.
I enjoyed it thoroughly, and I know others did, too. We'll hear back from people, I'm sure.
Okay. Well, I appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you,
Karuna. And we'll stay in touch.
Okay. This is Veronica Entwistle saying that was Karuna Caton with The Misleading Mind, Yours and Mine, and how to get in there and use Tibetan psychology, Buddhist, actually not Tibetan, Buddhist psychology to move through your changes. I really enjoyed it. So let us know what you thought. VeronicaEntwistle.com. Press the Ask Veronica button. Or you can write to Karuna at KarunaGroup.com. Yeah. Thank you so much for listening. Many blessings, everyone.